I remember we just did this bit of work where at Richard's house, Richard's got one of those beautiful old Victorian houses, you know, like with the 5-point bays. And you know where the glass over the years has run? And I was sitting on one of those secretary sort of swivel chairs. And I remember like sitting in the chair, looking out the window. And he says, oh, what's going on? I says, like, oh, David, there's all these questions and they're floating around out there and stuff like that. And he was just moving me in the chair, lining me up with the questions with the light coming through this glass.
Awesome.
And I just went, pachoom, that's it.
Welcome to Conversations in Clean, a podcast from Amphora Solutions. I'm Catherine Daly, and in this episode, Simon Coles and I talk with Sean Hotchkiss. Simon, tell us a bit about him before we get started.
So I guess I'm not alone in that the first time I met Sean was sort of both as Caitlin Walker's husband and also as the host and sometimes trainer of the events at West Kirby. And he always struck me as kind of interesting because he'd be spinning various plates and still be quite chatty and friendly to everybody. But then when you start chatting with Sean, not only do you find he's a lovely bloke, but also he's got his own clean story as well. So he spent a lot of time traveling with David Grove in the sort of latter part of his life when he was developing clean space and emergent knowledge. And I think you met Sean before you heard of Caitlin, didn't you?
Oh yeah, definitely. It was early on in my clean journey when I was training in symbolic modelling and his name came up. And so yeah, way before I came across Caitlin's work taking clean into the group settings.
One of the things I found really valuable, because I don't know, you know, I've come primarily from working groups in businesses and so on, and the symbolic world and the therapeutic world, I don't really understand it very much, but chatting with Sean, he makes it very easy to understand. And it turns out that Sean is actually doing therapy using clean in a therapeutic context, and then he'll get in the car and he'll go and do cleaning groups using systemic modeling and that sort of stuff. So he's one of the few people that's actually bouncing backwards and forwards between the two main areas that we use clean. And then obviously he's got his own sort of stuffing around clean space and the whirligig and so on. So if you want to understand how all the little bits of clean go together, what considerations you might need to think about if you're using clean in business in terms of safety and that sort of thing, and how those concerns are resolved in a therapeutic context, Sean's a really interesting guy to talk to. So there's a lot of things we could talk about, but what we thought we'd do just in this first discussion is spend some time asking Sean about the work that he does and his journey with clean.
Is there anything that you want people to know about your work that you never get asked?
Yeah, it's a real interesting question, isn't it? Sort of, I suppose. Just give me the question again. What do I get? What?
So you do work.
I do work. Yeah.
You're using clean out
using
in the world.
Clean, yeah.
And there's something, and people will ask you sometimes, I'm assuming, will ask about what you do.
Yeah.
Do,
yeah.
But things that you wanted people to know about what you do, but you don't ever get asked those things.
Let's come from it. So what do people ask?
We can start there.
Let's start with what people do. So people come to you with problems that have got going on.
Mm.
You know, anxiety, trauma, depression, you know, relationship problems, whatever. You know, people come with stuff. And I suppose the answer is going to be a bit more complicated. The people who come with symptoms, with traumas, they tend to be more local people. They tend to be desperate, you know, and want help, want a cure, want something. And what they don't do is they don't ask about methodology. They don't ask about the long-term possibilities. And what they're interested in is not having the problem, you know, not being depressed, not being anxious, not being traumatized, not arguing with their partner, not being lonely. So they're very much in a way from, and what they don't ask or what they don't want to know is what's really possible, you know. So we can get people, you know, a metaphor for it is, you know, a lot of people come and they feel like they're drowning. It's really easy, or not really easy, but, you know, our job is to help them get to the surface of the water so they can swim. But what we can do is we can teach them to fly. And people don't ask about that. They don't ask about, those kind of people tend not to ask about what are the big possibilities in life. Then I suppose another sort of set of clients, set of people we see, are people who are interested in the specific things that we're doing. So either systemic modeling, clean language, or the, you know, what I get asked a lot about is the integration of this with therapy and how does therapy and coaching thing. So those kind of people, I guess they kind of ask a lot of process technical questions and, you know, kind of discuss, you know, like sitting around, you know, around for hours talking about, you know, what's the best question? What are you thinking when this is going on? How do you model? Lots of that kind of stuff. But what aren't they asking? I'm not sure what they're not asking. But just as we're talking right now, I suppose the question that me and Caitlin haven't been asking ourselves, and Caitlin is now starting to challenge the question I'm starting to answer myself, is when you really start to embrace this stuff, not just as work, but almost as like a way of life, almost like as a path, you know, not like, you know, I suppose more like a sort of, almost similar to a Buddhist path, you know, like how are we going to look at ourselves so we progress? How does it become like a spiritual journey, or how does it become a, not sure if spiritual is the right word, a personal developmental journey that's more than just working on content and outcomes and results? You know, it sort of has a more spiritual feel to it. So I guess, you know, we don't get asked much about that. How I'm going to make this hard work for you to edit, but I'm going to jump around again. So I suppose what people don't ask, but is a really important part of how I work, is my developmental journey into this and how that affects what I do in the moment now. So the fact that, you know, I used to play rugby, catch rats, be very bouncy, quite hedonistic, but I bring some of that to my work now. And after that, when I kind of, you know, had my first little midlife crisis, I went to India and I studied Buddhism for a couple of years. And people don't, you know, that's a huge effect on my work. But people don't really ask about that. And then, like, being married to Caitlin, I suppose, that has, you know, how can that not affect, you know, everything I do in this field? But people don't really kind of go into that bit, you know. Like, occasionally, you know, like, I've chatted to you guys about it, you know, over dinner, and that's kind of why we're friends as well as colleagues and stuff like that. But it's the juicier bits of it, if that makes sense. And I suppose if I'm thinking back to David in a way, we spent loads and loads of time sitting around, you know, for want of a better phrase, you know, what on one level would be chatting shit, but really understanding things and each other, you know, like we were friends. Yeah. And, you know, that was really important in both my learning and the developmental stuff, you know.
I think that's the thing that's always intrigued me, and I think is undiscovered. You hear about Caitlin, and then you rock up somewhere and you bump into Sean, and spending even just a little bit of time with you, you go, bloody hell, you know, I mean, I've learned more from you about the interaction between what, say, you might do in a psychotherapy situation and how clean was originally developed, and how I might safely use it in the outside world. I've learned more from you than anybody else on that subject. Mm-hmm. And like you say, all the colourful stuff, which often doesn't get, because you're always, you've got your own job too, you know what I mean? But again, that's the other thing. It's like, we come up here and we're doing a training course, and Caitlin's generally doing the training, and you're doing your thing, but your thing is bloody interesting too.
Yeah, and I think the thing that, one of my big learnings over the last couple of years is, you know, Caitlin and Marion, I think what they're doing with training now is exceptional. And I'm not trying to do that.
Yeah.
And for me to be at my best, you know, it's like my metaphor for working with both Caitlin and Marion and other people is, I want to be the best wingman. Yeah. Because there's something about it, I'm just more relaxed. If they're holding the structure and they've got, you know, Caitlin's background's in linguistics, and, you know, Marion weaves threads into stuff, you know, that are exquisite. I don't do that. Yeah. But somehow, you know, like before we're chatting, you know, you're here, we're doing this, but we're also talking about what we're having for dinner. Yeah. And there's something gorgeous that comes out of that, if that makes sense. You know, it's more of a live process for me. Mm-hmm. And I find by letting Caitlin, Marin, and other people hold the big structure of the training, it gives me a massive freedom to be all of those things we were just talking about in the moment with yeah. people.
And then you have your your outside of doing clean life, because you do all sorts of interesting stuff with vulnerable kids, with in the mental health area and things like that. But and certainly with my interest in clean and business, I don't see that. I mean, you know, people occasionally talk about symbolic modeling as a in and a sort of one, then you get into, you know, you do coaching and you kind of, well, I've met a coach occasionally sort of thing, and I've been a coach. But therapy, I've got no idea what that is and what's the interaction between that. And I guess it's just really interesting to me that that perspective on things.
Yeah. And I love it. You know, it's, I really like doing the training, and you know, and I really like doing, I suppose, what we could call the formal therapy bit. But when you're out, you know, reaching hard to reach populations, you know, kids who are doing all sorts of things in all sorts of places, for somehow I'm natural with it. Yeah. And I found the same, you know, before I did this project, I worked a lot in recovery and drugs and alcohol and that kind of stuff. And there's something about me that I just fit into that chaos naturally, and I'm accepted. Mm. You know, and I remember I was working on, you know, quite a big drugs and alcohol project, you know, big NHS funded and stuff like that. And there was one part of it that was particularly for veterans. And it was really, really obvious that if you weren't a vet and you hadn't served, you would never be in that circle. You know, they were nice, they were friendly, they were great guys and ladies and everything like that. But there was something about, if you hadn't been there, you weren't in. And in the wider sort of community, if, you know, you're wandering around the streets and, you know, you're meeting these young people, somehow I'm in with them, if that makes sense. You know, the somehow the barriers that lots of people experience to engagement aren't there.
How do you do that? Do you know?
Yeah, no, not really. well, I mean, we can look at some of the behaviours. So I'm very relaxed with it. Mm. You know, I don't feel threatened. You know, lots of people walking up to groups of teenagers can feel that sort of stuff. So I don't feel threatened and stuff like that. Obviously, you've got to have a bit of an eye on safety, especially with sort of rising knife crime and, you know, when drugs are involved and that kind of stuff. But I think because I don't feel threatened, they don't feel threatened too. And then I think because I'm curious about what's going on, they tend to be curious back, if that makes sense. And what we do that's, I think, different from most other services is we're doing everything not to put a barrier in the way. So one of the things about clean in that sort of circumstance is we're moving very, very much to their world, and we're prepared to get involved in it. We're not just modelling, we're in it too. On loads of practical levels, you know, we've taken places, buy them food if they're hungry. One kid, you know, we got him a bike the other week. We just did a collection the other week for mobile phones, and we'll buy SIM cards for them. And, you know, so there's real practical stuff to it. So you've got to be useful. Like one of the best little things we've got at the minute is we've got some funding for young people to help them get identity. And then we worked out the cheapest identity thing we can get him is a provisional driving license.
Oh, really? Now,
for a 17-year-old boy, look, you know, meet me, mate. I'll get you your provisional. You know, great. Not particularly clean, a little bit of bribe, but all of these things kind of add up to a building rapport. That's the sort of the technical term. But we're okay with them. There's something about that we get each other.
Possibly part of that is personality and your natural way of being. I think when I've watched you work in Adventures in Clean and that sort of thing, you're technically skilled enough that you can execute the technical side of things, but still be very relaxed. You can do it in conversation. I've seen you just in the moment, and you're doing something else, and you're also.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's down to, you know, I label it, some of it's my dyslexic process. So what I can't do, so Caitlin, you know, her linguistic ability, Penny, James, Marion, you know, the linguistic abilities to model is, you know, incredible. And I just can't do that. And I realized really early on that that wasn't going to be my style. So then quite naturally, well, what do I do? And there's something about being with the person, kind of just being with them in what's going on, that kind of seems to get, it gets the effects. You know, it gets the change. It's hard to put into words, isn't it? It's certainly, you know, if you're asking clean questions, it's a linguistic process, and they're coming out with it. But yeah, I don't know.
We've started talking a little bit, and some of our test podcasts and things like that, the idea of living clean. Like, you've got some underlying things that we all know what they are, but we haven't quite written down about what it is to incorporate this stuff into your life.
Yeah.
And you express that in your way, and other people express that in their own ways.
Yeah, yeah.
The really interesting thing for me is how you might, or our typical interpretation of therapy, coaching, youth work, and that sort of thing is generally quite austere and remote. You know, you sort of wander into a therapist's room and he's sitting there with his carriage clock ticking away, you know.
We don't do that.
Yeah,
we don't do that.
What caused, so you did your rat catching and your rugby playing and all that sort of thing, and now you're a therapist. How did that happen?
Yeah. So a lot of theory says, organization comes from chaos. So it was a bit chaotic for a while.
Okay.
So I remember there's one Sunday morning and I played rugby and I was playing golf the next morning with the lads and we were all going out for dinner with the girls, you know, Sunday lunch. And I was just like going down the 13th at Mill Hill. And I just thought, there's got to be something more than this. And just like a chip in the windscreen, it was there. And then that chip slowly expanded. And I suppose the chaotic bit for me was I started being a bit of a pain in the arse, you know, because everyone else was sort of quite happy with their lives. But I'd be standing in the pub going, what are we doing? You know, like, getting quite frustrated, both mainly, I suppose, with myself now, you know, but I wasn't maybe quite as self-aware, having some beers and thing. And then I was sort of, you know, kerfuffling with my girlfriend at the time and we split up. And then I was kind of, you know, this is in 1999 and I'm, you know, sitting around in London catching wasps thinking, can't be asked being here for the millennium. So I'm off. So I found that some of the boys I used to play rugby with in New Zealand, I'm coming to New Zealand. And I just went to India for 3 months on the way. So I suppose it was that, you know, that growing frustration and just, you know, like a niggle, you know, the crack in the windscreen. And looking back on it, really creative developmental time, but you know, that's not the behavior you'd have seen.
Chaotic in the middle.
Yeah, when you look back on it, you know, you can romanticize it, but a bit chaotic.
So how did you find what came first, clean or Caitlin?
So when I was doing rat catching, I did a little bit of MBA kind of thinking and stuff. And I kind of realized after one module, I wasn't going to do the statistics module. I wasn't going to do the maths and that. But I quite liked some of the business thinking stuff. So early Charles Handy stuff, you know, and, you know, the Age of Unreason, I think it was. And I'd always quite liked Buddhist texts and that kind of stuff. So I think that came first. So then when I went to India, I met a monk and we started chatting and, I started to think about things like that. And that developed over a couple of years until, then I did some retreats and some training in it. And that was good. And then I was running my little retreat center in India. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, I was running it like you run a rugby club, you know. And I mean, great fun, you know. It's like, you know, lots of yoga followed by a barbecue and a few beers and a disco. You know, it was great. But I realized like something was missing in that, you know, started to get loads of problems because, you know, I thought you could do it with the same style as, you know, rugby and rats, you know what I mean? Yeah. And clearly you can't, as we know.
But you could do. It's you just could.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So then I thought, oh, I'll come back to, you know, I hurt my knee on the beach. So I needed to come back for a cartilage operation. So I thought I'll come back for a cartilage operation and I'll do a quick course in therapy or something like that. And then I'll be able to go back in 6 months and do it all. So in that time, I met Caitlin. Some of the problems in India around re-renting the place and buying it and stuff like that, they just became a bit bigger. And what I'm really pleased about is just as I was meeting Caitlin, I was looking at therapy courses and I'd already made the decision to do a 4-year master's in integrative psychotherapy as I was meeting Caitlin. And because I'd already got the Buddhist stuff, and then I'd committed to this, when I met Caitlin, clean, fitted with all of those sort of stuff. And it's really interesting now revisiting this. One of the things that I'm really interested in at the moment is looking at original Gestalt therapists and how clean maps on and helps me use their wisdom in a way that I find really useful. To look at how they work with gestures, the breath, being in the now,
you know,
and focusing on that rather than maybe problem, remedy, outcome sort of thing. You know, so I'm as interested in if someone goes, as I am if they, you know, tell me a problem.
Yeah. So you met Caitlin. And then you spent a lot, how did you end up spending a lot of time with David? How did that?
Caitlin and David had known each other for years and years and years. And David had been on a little bit of a wander. I think that was the time when he spent some time on his ship, and we think that's the time when he was sort of developing emergent knowledge and clean space, or you know, developing clean space and into emergent knowledge. So then David reappeared, and he was doing a course at Richard Stacey's house. So Caitlin said, "Yeah, go along, see David." She bought me a ticket and said, "You know, off you go. I'm going to leave you to it." And then it was really obvious when I first met David that he had a massive affection for Caitlin. So I kind of, you know, I had a natural rapport with him anyway. And of course, you know, it's got to be much more down to David's skills than mine, but he was a Kiwi. He liked his rugby and stuff like that. So, it was easy to get onto. Mm-hmm. And then I remember we just did this bit of work where at Richard's house, Richard's got one of those beautiful old Victorian houses, you know, like with the 5-point bays.
Yeah.
And do you know where the glass over the years has run? And I was sitting on one of those secretary sort of swivel chairs.
Yeah.
And I remember like sitting in the chair, looking out the window. And he says, "Oh, what's going on?" I says, "Like, oh, David, there's all these questions and they're floating around out there and stuff like that." And he was just moving me in the chair, lining me up with the questions with the light coming through this glass.
Awesome.
And I just went, "Pachoom, that's it." You know, it got my psyche. And I think I understood my spatial arrangements with my thoughts in a way that I just never got before. So that was great. So we loved all of that. And then we started hanging around together. And I suppose one of the, it depends who you ask, David or Caitlin, because Caitlin was then, we quickly got pregnant, which was lovely. So she was doing that. And then David just started hanging around with us more. So when we were living in Hull, he'd come and stay with us there. When we moved to West Kirby, he came and lived with us here for a while. So we were just around all the time. So Caitlin was sort of doing her stuff and being pregnant, and we were playing. It was great. Yeah, it was great.
And one of the things you were playing with was the Welly gig?
Yeah. That was all around that time. He was playing with lots of things. And I suppose now maybe bits of it have been lost, and you know, we certainly need to go back and look at some of the things that he was playing with, for example. But we need to go back and look at it. But the big thing that he was playing with then was space and direction. And we started off with all sorts of things. So he was buying wheelchairs with motors on, so the client could, you know, like relocate themselves, and then they'd go up and down and extend, but then people fell off them and, you know, that wasn't working. And then one day, you know, he'd stay up all night doing things, and he just bought this gyroscope off eBay. And then, you know, he developed it. We bought other bits and pieces, put different chairs in it. And he just spent really hours playing with it, hours and hours playing with it. And yeah, really interesting times. And the thing about David is, I must have told this story a lot, so excuse me if you heard it before, but I remember we had the Whirly gig outside our house, and the guy from over the road, we lived in like a terrace and parking was a little bit tight, and the guy from over the road came over to complain about it. So, you know, being my usual self, I'd have probably gone and had an argument. But David says, "Oh, you know, like blah, 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 it's this and it's that." And then 3 minutes later, the postman was walking past. So David had the postman in it, upside down, asking him questions, explaining what was going on to the guy across the road and stuff like that. And all of a sudden, everyone in the community is into it. Amazing. Yeah, you know, amazing. Just like that. Yeah, just like that.
So I always thought the Whirly gig was very weird.
Yeah.
And I still think it's weird, but it is quite, there's something about it.
Absolutely, there's something about it, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
What? Why? How?
What, why, how? I don't want to answer that question.
Okay.
And the reason being is, and I think this is the first time I've said this out loud, is what we're intending to do next with the Whirly gig, to sort of write it up, is to get other people to answer those questions. Okay. Because what we do know is true, and I know we can generate, is client experience. And we need to be doing a bit more client work, a little bit more recording of it and of people's experience, and get that observed and supervised. Because we know it works, and we know it works for all sorts of things, and I can give you loads of stories about that. But that's like, that's our evidence, you know, that case study, that's happened. And then what I'd really like to do with it is to get that looked at by people who can answer those questions a little bit more. So what, you know, how, why, and stuff like that. Because generally what happens is the people can answer it from their own perspective.
Yeah.
So one of the amazing things the Whirligig does with anxiety is it helps you find a still spot, a space where maybe for the first time your system can relax and kind of release something. Now, yoga teachers are great on giving you explanations for that. Like there's something about the breath and stuff like that. You know, they explain that. A massage therapist is going to give you a different answer about how it might be releasing some fascia and stuff like that. I don't know what a cranial sacral therapist would say, but we could work on that. But then also, like a psychologist who's working on dissociation might go, well, where's the dissociation gone and what's the alignment there? So I'd be more interested in finding out what other fields, and obviously six other fields,
of course, yeah,
think what's going on with the evidence from the clients. And then from that, well, it doesn't matter who's right or wrong, there's just maybe a way of explaining it in different ways. Because people, you know, and then maybe there's a way of replicating it differently or something from that.
Because it's a very intriguing thing, and one I've not seen much elsewhere, that sort of use of orientation in space.
Yeah, I agree. There's spatial yoga now, where you know, you can hang from ropes and stuff like that. I've seen that.
Watsu, have you come across Watsu, which is shiatsu in the water?
No.
So people get positioned within the right, water, but no, that holds them buoyant.
I want to go with that.
Okay.
Yeah, and there is, you know, there's flotation chambers and loads of things like that. See, so now if we were David, we'd be online ordering one of those and we'd have some hanging hammocks here. And
well, that's, isn't yeah, that what cool experimentation?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I'm getting online now.
Yeah, absolutely. And as long as Caitlin's not listening, order away.
So, yeah, we still need to buy a Whirligig for down south, don't we?
Yeah.
I think you have to make one, don't you?
No.
You can buy them, but then they need adjusting. So they need that third ring putting on, which is quite a thing. And again, you know, when we win the lottery, I think the way to do it is the very big and the very heavy. The way to do it would be to get it motorized, and to be wearing headphones and stuff like that, so you can talk to the clients a little bit clearly, and you can move it a lot slower
and have it inside.
And have it inside, yeah.
So we've been going for a little while, and I appreciate you've got a client. So thank you for sort of finding a slot.
Yeah.
You know, we come and invade your home, and it's like, yes.
Yeah, and you're welcome. You're welcome, guys. Yeah.
One thing that dyslexia.
Yeah.
It's a big thing.
Huge thing.
Your relationship with the written word is very different from...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But at the same time, I find it inspiring in that I didn't notice. I noticed your strengths.
Yeah.
Your relationships with clients and stuff like that. I saw you do a symbolic modeling coaching thing at Adventures in Clean, and you absolutely nailed it. It was like a hole in one.
But
the writing stuff is hard, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
How does that affect you day to day?
Don't do it. So I work with Natalie, who is, it's like we're recruited for diversity.
Yeah.
Natalie is a great coach, and her working memory is superb. Her organization skills are superb. And if I'm sitting, you know, with a young person or a group of young people, we chat away and I say, Natalie, can you jot that? Can you diary that? And she'll go, oh, look, this fits here, blah, blah, blah. And we put the jigsaw together. So it works like that. The bit that I'm not getting done is, so it's like with the thing that's coming out of the working with the young people, we're not capturing enough of it. And I kind of noticed the people who blog, who do Facebook things, they naturally do it. It's like Caitlin has her phone and she's as likely to post a photo of a chicken as she is of, you know, something interesting happened today. I don't know where my phone is now. I'm more thinking about, you know,
Well, hopefully that's how podcasting can be level the ground a little bit.
Yeah.
We have had a period of time where the internet's been all text-based.
Okay.
And that's very disenfranchising.
Yeah.
A segment of the population.
And on the topic of the spoken word and dyslexia and clean, because that's a spoken thing as well as a gestural spatial thing. Is there a relationship between you knowing clean and dyslexia that's enabled you to understand your dyslexia
in
a different way?
Absolutely. And I suppose I got this, I was working with a client the other day and she had quite severe OCD and she'd seen lots of OCD specialists and was getting some results, but, you know, wasn't happy. And I'd been working with someone else who recommended me, which is nice. And she was talking to me and saying, are you an expert in OCD? No. You know, it's like, but what I am pretty good at is I'm going to model you and we're going to find out more about your OCD and you, and you're going to become the world expert on you and your OCD like you've never done it before. And I believe that's going to help. And she just went, yep, I'll have some of that. So with me and my dyslexia, I understand it loads better because I've been able to model it. I've come up with more personal strategies with it. But I think that, again, this is the bit that a lot of dyslexia coaches and neurodiverse coaches miss and probably get from David in the more therapeutic thing. Something like, you know, OCD or dyslexia that's been with you all your life, there's a chronicness to it, and you know it has the elements of a complex post-traumatic stress. It affects your sense of self and who you are in the world. And again, you know, having clean and being able to sort out your own metaphors, you know, like to get the stuff on a deeper metaphorical level for who you want to be and how you want to be and stuff like that. I think that really adds something to the work. That straightforward coaching is the wrong word, but you know, like coaching to models, you know, taking someone through the grow models, not kind of going to give you that depth of work that I think clean and metaphor and the other stuff will. And I think the two processes, even if you're not doing it as a therapist or, you know, deep psychotherapy, if you're modeling someone's metaphors, automatically you're getting that deeper level of work that you might not be getting elsewhere.
And also, I think there's probably something about being in an environment where people have clean, other people have clean.
So being accepted.
Being accepted and inquired of, and this thing about, well, your experience is not my experience, and how do we...
And also being in this environment, I don't have to try and fit, I just do.
Yeah.
You know, it's like...
You be at your best.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, so, you know, no one's really expecting me to... you know, go and write this up in an email now. You know, what people are really expecting me to do is go sort out dinner and make sure we've got a decent bottle of red for tonight, you know?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, that's how it goes, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, with that, thank you very much for listening. And we'll let Sean go to his next client. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, till next time. Thank you.
All right, take care.